Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces, episode 116. I hope you all had a fantastic weekend and are ready to tackle this week with full force. We are starting this week off with an awesome guest and somebody I was glad we were able to bring up on the show. So huge thank you to Bob Van Kirk for getting this set up. But today's guest is going to be Lee Bratcher with the Texas Blockchain Council. So good morning, Lee. How are you doing?
Hey, good morning, Coleman. I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for asking. So again, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And I look forward to picking your brain on a couple of these bills that Texas has in the, getting voted on right now and kind of everything you're doing with the Texas Blockchain Council and kind of your, what you see happening with this organization over the next 5 years. So if you don't mind, Lee, just kind of start off, like, what got you into Bitcoin and what made you want to start the TBC?
Yeah. And it's an honor to be here. I kind of appreciate, I've been watching what you guys have doing with these, been doing with these spaces and aggregating the Bitcoin veteran community. It's very admirable. So it's an honor to be here. And I'll jump back into kind of my background. I was never active duty. So I spent about 14 years in the reserves, came out of OCS, Army OCS, in 2011. So I didn't actually get into Bitcoin until I was at the Army War College on like a temporary assignment, researching, for an academic role, researching peacekeeping and stability operations. So there's actually an institute there at the War College called the Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute. So I was a civil affairs guy, and that's where I, first read the Bitcoin white paper. I was trying to understand how property rights increases people's propensity to towards like community building and peacekeeping, essentially, and away from joining insurgencies. And so I was mostly focused on real property rights, and then read the Bitcoin white paper and started to focus on digital property rights. And that's where I sort of begin to think about what it would look like to further the policy around Bitcoin and physical or digital property rights in the U.S. And started the Texas Blockchain Council a year or two later in 2019. So that's kind of how I got everything going.
That's awesome, Lee, and good morning. What was the impetus for it? Like, what was the original idea, in terms of the Texas Blockchain Council? Like, where did you guys start? How did you formulate, setting it up?
Yeah. So at the time I was a political science professor at a university in Dallas called Dallas Baptist University. As, had just come back from the War College doing that brief academic stint there and wrote a paper on the topic, and it touched on digital property rights. And so I just started going to a few events and realizing that at that time in 2019, the Bitcoin space and the digital asset space in general was not that great at liaising with elected officials or policymakers. And so I started just doing, on the side, just working, setting up meetings with elected officials, with people that I knew that were maybe Bitcoin miners or they were investors or, people that needed to get in touch with elected officials. And I had a podcast where I'd interview people. That's how I kind of got into that. It's always a good, the podcast never, unless you're the top 1% of podcasts, they're pretty tough to make work from an economic standpoint. So the podcast never made any money, but it was a great way to get in touch with and have a conversation with, people that were movers and shakers in the industry. And so, from there, I formed the 501c6 trade association that became the Texas Blockchain Council, because I realized there was a need for people to set up those conversations with regulators and to be a liaison between the industry and elected officials, you know, particularly because people in the industry were so busy building, you know, developing, building products, shipping products that they didn't have time to set up these conversations. And it would have been a waste of their creative energy to take that time to do that. And they also didn't know really where to start. And so I just created a niche for myself in that, you know, translating between the policy world and those that were building. And, you know, fast forward 5 years and we've passed a couple pieces of legislation in Texas. We've tried to make Texas the global leader in Bitcoin and digital assets. I think Wyoming still probably has us beat by a little bit from a policy perspective, but the Texas economy is about 50 times the size of the Wyoming economy. So while they may have us beat from a policy perspective, with a few extra bills, of course, they've got the special purpose depository institution there in Wyoming. We don't have that. They also have a new Duna DAO that replaced their blockchain LLC DAO from the last session, which is another thing that we don't have here in Texas. We were working on it. We tried to pass it last session in Texas in 2022, or I guess that would have been 2023, but it was unsuccessful. So we're going back for another round. The Texas legislature meets every 2 years. So every odd year, the Texas legislature is in session for 6 months. It's a pretty tight window. Got a lot of stuff going on in the next 5 months while we meet, you know, the end of May is when that session wraps up. So.
Lee, do you want to touch on the Duna DAO and just what the difference is so the audience can kind of understand one, what Wyoming has, but then also like why it might make sense for Texas and other states to look at such a structure?
Sure. I am by no means a DAO expert, but I have been working on the policy of getting a DAO established, a DAO entity formation structure established in Texas, so I can share what I know. So the Duna, the UNA is an unincorporated nonprofit association. That is an entity structure that's been around for decades in many states. And typically it's for like cattle ranchers associations or different groups that don't really want to have a board. They don't really want to have a formal entity. So they've created this entity structure called an unincorporated nonprofit association that can still have a bank account and still, you know, achieve, sort of decentralized, economies of scale and purpose for whatever group it is. Typically, like I said, it's like an ag group, a ranchers association, something like that. And so the Duna, which is just adding the D to the front, is the decentralized unincorporated nonprofit association. It's a brainchild of, well, I don't know exactly who first came up with it, but I know that the lawyers that have really perfected the language, Miles Jennings, who's one of the general counsels at A16Z and, goodness, one other attorney whose name is escaping my mind right now, David Kerr, both of which are, you know, probably 25 years of experience in, as attorneys and with forming structures for funds and different things. And they're both pretty, you know, I'd say world renowned experts on sort of the DAO entity structure space. And they passed the Duna structure in Wyoming last year, which replaced the blockchain LLC that was passed the year before in Wyoming. And the blockchain LLC didn't really have any uptake. It was neither limited liability or a good structure for DAOs. And so they replaced that with the Duna there in Wyoming.
Oh, thank you for that, Lee. So I do want to ask you a little bit. For one, I don't know, I'm not sure how much you can tell us on this, but how much did the Texas Blockchain Council and yourself work on getting the Texas legislation, going to get it onto a vote to create a strategic Bitcoin reserve?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we started working on that concept about 3 years ago with Chairman Capriglione. It was actually at a BitBlock Boom conference in Dallas where I connected with, I've known the chairman for, you know, 5 or 6 years, but he and I happened to both be there and we were talking about this concept. And initially we were thinking we were going to have to create a trust and have Bitcoin be in that trust. And then the trust, the beneficiary of the trust would be the Texas Comptroller. And that's how we were going to get Bitcoin on the balance sheet of the state of Texas. And that structure, you know, we had worked on that, you know, created a legal entity and, thought through that for a while. But then when the federal, you know, obviously when it got supercharged, several months ago when we realized that Trump was going to win the election in November, and Chairman Capriglione and I and his staff and the TBC staff started working on a Texas Strategic Bitcoin Reserve bill that would contemplate the state of Texas taking direct custody. I mean, they would have taken direct custody in the trust idea anyways. It was just a different vehicle to get the Bitcoin to the state. In this way, donors, Bitcoin donors, you know, mostly going to be Bitcoin mining companies that are looking for a PR win, you know, or they're looking for recognition from the state of Texas for donating a Bitcoin or half a Bitcoin or something. That was how it got started. And that was how Chairman Capriglione's bill was filed initially several months ago. And then it really caught fire, as you guys have seen over the last, you know, lots of states have introduced legislation. You know, I think the federal government contemplating a reserve has, you know, added some gasoline to the fire as well. And so then we worked with Senator Shortner's office. He's the chairman of the Texas Business and Commerce Committee on a new version of the bill that would see the Texas comptroller or the general fund actually purchase Bitcoin. Up to 1% of the general fund could be used to purchase Bitcoin for the Texas Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. So that's where the bill stands now. There's a House version of the bill that Giovanni Capriglione has. There's a Senate version that Chairman Shortner has. And, love, you know, Coleman and Bob and anybody else who's listening, I'd love to get y'all's, feedback on this. Right now, you know, there is a lot of, there's a lot up in the air with which bill will end up making it, you know, to reconciliation. So, the House bill or the Senate version, you know, the Senate version again is the one that would see about 1% of the Texas general fund be used to purchase Bitcoin. And Texas runs a surplus, constitutionally required to run a surplus. We have a multi-billion-dollar surplus this year, just because we're pretty, as you guys can imagine, Texas is quite, fiscally conservative with how we use our tax resources. And so, yeah, just love y'all's feedback on both versions of the bill. Obviously one of them has a 5-year holding period. The House version has a 5-year holding period. The Senate version does not. The comptroller really does not want to have their hands tied about when they could liquidate the fund. And so currently the Senate version, the bar is it could be liquidated at any time, but it has to be an emergency and it has to have 2/3 of the legislature or the governor has to convene the legislative budget board, and detail an emergency. I think the bill will be unlikely to pass if we don't give the comptroller that level of flexibility because they could testify, you know, negatively on the bill and that would spook some of the senators or some of the House members. So would love y'all's feedback on if, you know, allowing them that flexibility, if the governor were to declare an emergency or the House had a 2/3 majority, they could liquidate the Bitcoin. Is that a sacrifice? I mean, all of us would probably say hold it for a decade, right? But is that a sacrifice that as a community we would be willing to make in order to get the bill passed? Like, I think it improves the bill's chances of passing from less than 50% to, you know, somewhat much higher than 50%, like maybe 75%. If we keep the comptroller happy and they testify positively about the bill, I think the bill is going to pass. Yeah. So I'll shut up and see if there's any thoughts, feedback on that question.
Bob, do you want to go first?
Well, I was just going to say, I think, both are positive, obviously. But having that two thirds majority vote to liquidate, is a reasonably high bar. So I think just personally, I think that that's, you know, gives them the out if they need to spend it for some reason, but knowing that Texas is so conservative, fiscally conservative, and has a surplus, it'd be hard to see why they would come up against some sort of emergency to want to liquidate that. So I guess my personal feeling is still, super positive, and giving them that out is, probably reasonable. And like you said, Lee, probably makes the comptroller look a little bit more favorably on the bill when they testify.
I would, I'm going to take a different stance on this. And I know that the headline coming out is going to be the first state to come out of the U.S. to get this passed is going to be the talking point, right? And all the Bitcoiners will kind of bow down to them and give them, you know, the golden crown. But I think if we're going to push through something, even in Texas, I think it's just best, even if it has to wait another 2 years before it gets perfected, I think that might be the best way to go. I think you said the first bill in the House is donation only, so they don't plan on purchasing any. It's only just by whoever wants to pay the revenues or lobbyists paying in Bitcoin. I think that's cool, but that's not what we should base it off of. I do agree with Bob, like two thirds of a vote, you know, that it will take a large majority, but as a Bitcoiner, again, we should have a low tie preference. And if we have to wait another cycle or another 2 years for this to get kind of really mainstream and everybody understand it, as long as it's going to be net positive for the end goal is going to be net positive, I think we just slow it down and just let maybe another state go out and see how it works and kind of watch them fail because they just rushed it through. I think this is one of the things where if you have a loophole or if there's a way to kind of take advantage of the way the law was written, I think bad actors will do that. And I don't think that's necessarily a positive for Texas or the Texas citizens.
Lee, what do you think the risk is of waiting? And so I like Coleman's point. Yeah, low time preference. But what do you think the risk is of waiting, knowing that the legislature meets every odd year?
Yeah, I feel like we kind of missed the moment, the zeitgeist of the moment, if you will. And to Coleman's point, I think part of that was taken care of a little bit in the iteration between the House version and the Senate version. I mean, the Senate was able to see the House version, get some feedback from industry, from the comptroller, and then they put forward a bill that was a little bit more perfected, if you will. And so I don't think we're rushing anything. I think the House version is going to assimilate to the Senate version at some point, or maybe by committee substitute, you know, you substitute in the Senate version. I tend to think that we should press forward with it, because we do have those iterations of, you know, experimentation even before the session is over between getting a bill out there quickly, which was the House one that was a good bill to be sure. And then the Senate having some time and Senator Shortner's office having some time to, you know, contemplate what those changes might need to be and file a bill a little bit later that was a little bit more perfected. And so I do think that that Senator Shortner's bill that's out right now is the best bill of all the 14 or so states that have filed a Bitcoin Strategic Reserve bill. So I tend to think that we should press forward. Again, 2 years what if Bitcoin is at $250,000 or $500,000 2 years from now? It would be a lot harder to build the reserve. And we would have, the state of Texas kind of would have missed out on that. So I definitely agree that we shouldn't rush anything, but I do think that we've had that iteration, that time to iterate on it and to perfect it. And you still have the committee hearings that will happen. And I'm sure the bill will change a little bit between now and then. Those are just my thoughts, but I do appreciate the feedback. I haven't we haven't had time to get a lot of feedback on the bill just because we've been working mostly with the committee staff and everybody internally on thinking through the mechanics of it. Cause it's quite complex, right? You've got the comptroller's office. You've got the Texas Safekeeping and Trust Division. They're going to have to get a qualified custodian. Of course they could do like multi-institutional custody perhaps, but you know, it's just, it's not possible for the state of Texas to do self-custody at this time just because of the liability. But there'll be either a qualified custodian or multi-institutional custody or something of that nature. So.
And Lee, I want to make sure you understand, like, I'm not giving you a hard time for getting this through. I applaud all the work that you and the TBC is doing to get this out there and actually bring it out to a vote. Like, again, I commend you for that. I'm very impressed. My biggest thing is if we had a choice, I would just hate to rush this and then just completely screw it up. So we have to wait an extra time before we're able to bring it back up if we just sell it for some reason. But the follow-up question I had was you said, the comptroller would need a 2/3 vote to go ahead and move the funds. Does that vote only happen every 2 years or can they call an emergency meeting to go ahead and get that taken care of within 30, 60 days?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the bill as written is 2/3 resolution by both chambers while this legislature is in session for those 6 months on odd number years. And then if not, it's a legislative budget board, approval from the governor. So the governor and the legislative budget board would be the ones that would make that call if the legislature is out of session. So it is a pretty high bar. I think it's an appropriate, I think it's a bar that will likely never be met because Texas is so fiscally responsible that we continue to have budget surpluses year over year. And, I think it'll all kind of be a moot point, in the end because we do have those surpluses typically and a financial emergency is pretty unlikely given that we have such a great tax base here in the state. We're growing and we tend to spend very frugally. I just noticed actually one of the members of Chairman Schwartner's staff is on the spaces. I won't call her out at the moment, but if she's welcome to request to speak, and I'm sure Bob and Coleman wouldn't mind bringing her up. If she would want to, she may not be, she may be driving to work and not be, prepared to jump on to speak, but, we do have a member of the Senator Schwartner's staff. He is the chairman of the Business and Commerce Committee. Again, I'm not going to call out who it is, but I just noticed as I was looking through who the attendees were that she's on the line.
Yeah, if you'd like to come up, open invitation. No pressure with that. I'm going to spend a little bit more time on here, Bob, if that's okay. Lee, if you said that if we can get this amendment to the bill and allow the comptroller to go ahead and have a little bit more power control, you said you'd put the odds at about 75% of it going through, give or take?
Yeah, that's what I would estimate right now, just because it did make the lieutenant governor's list of priority bills. He only, I think it was 40 priorities that he listed, and the Bitcoin, strategic Bitcoin reserve bill was 21st on the list. Obviously 21 being he had somebody in his office suggest that he used that number, obviously a significant number with just, 21 million Bitcoin in existence. So he is fast becoming, educated on the topic. I think the entire Texas legislature is pretty, pro hard money. It obviously Bitcoin being a new form of hard money, it's going to take some time for all of the members to get comfortable, but Chairman Schwartner's office has gotten comfortable very quickly. And so I would say, there's nothing that's certain in the legislature. There could be chaos, and very few bills get through. I mean, typically only about 10% of the bills that are filed get passed in the Texas legislature. We'll probably have more than 5,000 bills filed. Sometimes it approaches 10,000 bills. So you really don't have a high ratio of passing these bills. but it has support from both chambers. The authors of the bill are both chairmen of respective committees. Now, it's not the committees that the bill will go through, but chairmen are typically quite powerful. And so, you know, other chairmen will let their bills fly through their committees because they want, you know, the same recognition or favors from the chairman of other committees. So, you know, chairman bills often get a little bit of quicker hearing, if you will. And all those reasons, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't pass. But again, I'm going to leave a 25% chance that it doesn't pass just because anything can happen in the legislature. Bills are meant to, you know, the Texas legislature in particular is meant for bills to die because, you know, here in Texas, we don't love a lot of regulations. So, you know, it's kind of designed for bills to die. So I do need to kind of reserve a 25% chance. Now, if the comptroller gets frustrated with the bill then it has a pretty poor chance of passing, right? Because the comptroller testifies negatively about it in a committee hearing and, you know, then it gets concerning. I do think that, the two authors of the bill on the House and Senate side could probably pass a bill over the comptroller's objections, but that's just not a place where anybody wants to be. I mean, Texas is pretty pro-business, and I think all the members, the comptroller, all be on the same sheet of music and push forward innovation together. That's really where we want to be. And that's kind of the reason for my, you know, thought process on the percentages. You know, it's really hard to put an actual number on it, but you held my feet to the fire, so I did.
No, you're good. One last question for me on this. How quickly are we going to hear something that has got voted on or that they're making some tweaks to it? Are we 2 weeks out, 4 weeks out? I know end of May is kind of the deadline because that's when everything stops, but.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's been referred to the Senate version of the bill has been referred to the Finance Committee. As I checked. So I don't know when a hearing might be. I think probably in the next, I'd say sometime in March, you'd see hearing. Right now, they're only taking on things that are the governor's emergency items. They're not allowed to bring bills to hearing unless it was listed as an emergency item by the governor. And then I don't know the exact day, but something like 45 days into the legislative session, they can bring up traditional bills that were not listed as emergency items by the governor. And the person who's on staff will... who again, I'm not mentioning a person's name, not just to keep their privacy intact. They'll probably send me a text and be like, it's not 45 days. It's 60 days or something. I don't know exactly. I think it actually might be 60 days. Anyways, there is a period of time where you can't bring up bills that were not emergency items. So long story short, we'll probably get into a committee hearing in March sometime.
Perfect. Well, I look forward to hearing some more on that. And again, thank you so much for everything you're doing with that and that bill. Being a Texan, I do hope that we do get it through. And we are one of the first ones. So I just want to make sure it's done right. So thank you, Lee, for everything you've done with that. If you don't mind, I would like to kind of go switch it over to the mining and kind of what Texas has done to allow all these Bitcoin miners to come here and kind of strengthen our grid. And I would like to see if you have any information on this last couple of winter storms we had over the last 2 months, what the miners did to curtail that load demand and how vital they are to keeping our grid stable.
Yeah, it's a great question. So there is about 3,200 megawatts of Bitcoin mining in Texas. Put that in perspective, on a day like today, we'll probably get, you know, 70,000 megawatts of demand. You know, you're looking at 4% or so of the total demand on the grid is going to Bitcoin mining. Data center demand is going to be about double that for traditional hyperscaler data center, cloud data centers. So we do have quite a bit of that load here in Texas. And then of course there's more of that coming. So the unique thing about Bitcoin mining load is it is a flexible load, like you referenced, Coleman. The break even for Bitcoin miners is pretty low because the hash price is quite low right now. And the hash price is calculated based on the price of Bitcoin, and a difficulty level. And, you're essentially, you know, with the halving that took place in April, with a lot of miners coming online, you have over 800 exahash of Bitcoin mining on the network. You know, the hash price, I haven't looked today, but it's probably somewhere around $50 a hash, which is not great. It's miners are not profitable, but that's very good for the Texas grid because that means our break even point is quite low. So like it's around $100 a megawatt hour right now. So Bitcoin miners will curtail their power consumption, started around $100 a megawatt hour. And to again, to put that in perspective, wholesale, like current, if you look at the ERCOT app right now, wholesale power prices are probably around $50 a megawatt hour at the moment, depending on if it's kind of a cloudy day. So there's not a lot of solar that's ramped up yet. At least I don't think so. There's not in Dallas, it's cloudy. I'm not sure about West Texas where the solar is, but, you can see all that on the cut out and see what the pricing is. So that's a good thing because that means we're even more price sensitive and we're more flexible. Our loads are more flexible. So, the nice thing about the winter storms, though, is we didn't ever get into a pinch. There was no ERCOT, emergency request. The price of power stayed relatively low throughout. There's a lot of extra capacity on it. I checked a couple times during some of those cold winter snaps in January, and there's like 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 megawatts of spare capacity on grid. So the miners didn't really need to curtail as much this time as they have in years past. And honestly, you wouldn't want them to, right? If there's low prices and there's lots of spare capacity, the miners curtailing would actually be a bad thing for the grid because that's why the market mechanism works so well. They would drive the price even further by removing even more demand. And if you drive the price down too far, then our traditional coal, natural gas, generation is going to get crushed, right? They're going to be making no money and they're going to be even less likely to build, new power plants. So we want to pick up the price of power overnight and in times of low demand. And that's what Bitcoin miners can do. Really, the only times you want to see a miner curtailing are during those price spikes and high demand times. And that's typically only about 1% of the year. And so that 1% is a crucial 1%, and you need to have load ready to go off. And batteries are excellent. Batteries we've got over 3,000 megawatts of batteries now in Texas, which is a crazy fast growth as well. So the Texas grid is becoming more robust by the day. You have over 3,000 megawatts of batteries that can, go on and off. You know, the problem with batteries is they can only discharge for 2 hours. Bitcoin miners can stay off for indefinitely. So if you have like an 8 hour, 24 hour, 72 hour storm, Bitcoin miners can stay off all that entire time, but batteries can only discharge for 2 hours. So batteries are great, but Bitcoin miners have that added benefit of being able to be off for, multiple days if need be. Batteries are a little bit better at, frequency response. So batteries do a lot more with like keeping the grid frequency at 60 hertz. Cause if you deviate too much below or above that, it can damage the transmission lines. So Bitcoin miners can do that. They can do, frequency response, but, it's a little bit easier for the batteries to do it just because they're on the supply side and we're on the demand side. So each kind of load has their place. Of course, now we're looking at the Texas A&M launching the small modular reactor there at their Relis campus, which is very exciting. I think Texas really needs a lot of more nuclear. Only about 8% of Texas power is currently generated by nuclear at the moment. And Bitcoin and nuclear are a perfect match, right? Because you can put Bitcoin mining behind an SMR, small modular reactor, while you wait for the transmission to build out to get that power to the broader market. And once the transmission is built out, then the Bitcoin miner can go somewhere else and that power can then be sold to the broader market. So, but there might be 2 years of excess power where that SMR is like, just taking it in the teeth and not being able to sell their power to the market because they're waiting for transmission build out.
Lee, do you think that these energy companies are finally starting to realize this, like the importance of having mobile Bitcoin miners that they can just go ahead and just set up and wait till everything, like you just said? Are they starting to understand it, or is there still quite a bit of a learning curve?
I think they are. I mean, we're having conversations with Calpine, Vistra, some of the largest energy generation companies in the world, really, and some of the largest in Texas. I think they're definitely understanding it, you know, and as many of you guys know, there's two types of Bitcoin mining load. There's containerized Bitcoin mining, which is somewhat flexible. Like you can move the containers. You can't really move the substation that you spent millions of dollars on building. I mean, I guess you can, but it's quite expensive. And then there's also the permanent data center type of Bitcoin mining. So, I think with the nuclear reactors, you'd probably want to put the mobile containers that you would put out like on a flare gas well that you're using a generator to generate electricity on. And that would, you know, as long as you're not having to build extra generation, like if they already have a substation there because they're waiting for, that distribution level transmission line to be built, then it's a perfect match, right? You don't have to move the substation. You can just move the Bitcoin mining containers after a couple of years when that SMR is able to sell their energy to the broader marketplace, the ERCOT marketplace. So lots of potential to you know, sit behind the meter. You don't even have to be behind the meter, honestly. You could be in front of the meter next to a SMR, next to a natural gas generation plant that's maybe, you know, because these combined cycle plants, if they're not running optimally, like the turbines are using more gas to produce less electricity if they're only running at like 50% capacity. So putting a Bitcoin miner there, letting those turbines run at their optimal efficiency level, is quite good for the power plant. It helps their profit margins and also quite good for, you know, the Bitcoin miner.
How much more room does Texas have to grow with its mining sector? Because correct me if I'm wrong, we are the largest, we have the most miners in the country, correct?
That's right. Yeah, we've got about between 40 and 50% of the hash rate in the U.S. If you take just public miners, it's actually closer to 50%. If you add in the private miners, it probably drops down, you know, below 50%, between 40 and 50%. So, we don't have much room to grow, and I'll tell you why. It's because the AI and HPC data centers are willing to pay way more for those sites and that power than we are. As I mentioned, you know, you're flirting with like $50 a petahash and hash price right now, and the miners just aren't going to pay 10 cents, 15 cents kilowatt hour for power. It's just not profitable. And, but AI data centers and HPC data centers will pay that, cause they've got, you know, deep pockets and public market liquidity and all that stuff. The multiples at which like an AI data center company trades at are much higher than a Bitcoin mining, even a public Bitcoin mining company. So they just have more cash to throw around. And so I anticipate, unless we have a crazy high run up in the Bitcoin price, we're going to grow. We're already seeing the pace of growth in Texas grow to less than like 40 megawatts a month. Whereas like a year ago, we were growing at like 90 megawatts a month. So it's going to slow down.
Lee, with HPC though, I think the one drawback is they need that power all the time, right? So there's still a place for Bitcoin miners. Is that right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. There'll always be a place for a flexible power consumer. Bitcoin mining is never going to go away. Well, I guess it will in 120 years when all the Bitcoin has been mined, but then they'll still be mining for fees, right, and securing the network. So hopefully by then there'll be a lot more fee revenue for the miners a century from now. We'll all be dead, but the HPC is currently firm load. I think there will quickly come a time when they become flexible load. For a couple of reasons. One, if you're running inference, you got to be always on, and they have to have five nines of redundancy and all this stuff. I think they're going to eventually realize, all right, if we have several inference data centers, we can shift some of that load around. And if there's some place in the market where one of our inference data centers is paying, you know, they're on like wholesale spot pricing. I mean, most of those data center guys are going to hedge their power prices anyways. And if they hedge, they could sell back. And then their opportunity cost to not sell back, if you hedge at, say, $80 a megawatt hour, but price of power is at $1,000 a megawatt hour for like a 30-minute interval, you know, there's 5-minute pricing intervals in ERCOT, you're leaving a lot of money on the table, like millions and millions of dollars on the table. So what I'm saying is I think they'll eventually figure out that they should be flexible, and they'll just transfer that inference load to somebody else. Now, I don't think the cloud people will ever be flexible, but I do think AI and HPC will be flexible. There's already software out there that can tune up and tune down those loads and allow them the model to, you know, if it's training, that can keep training just at a lower speed. And if it's inference, you know, it's all kind of speculative right now though, because we haven't really seen a flexible load AI data center, and we may not see one for many years because they're just extremely price insensitive. But I think eventually some power trader is going to be like, hey, you just left $5 million on the table because you weren't willing to curtail for 10 minutes. Could you potentially shift some of that inference load to one of your other data centers for 10 minutes so that we can, you know, and maybe people's, AI GPT queries are coming back a few milliseconds slower, but people are profit minded and I think they'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, not to shift topics too much, but a comment you made earlier about Texas having maybe a ceiling on, the power production, especially as it relates to miners. I've heard that, Georgia has quite a bit of mining. Do you know anything about that? And how does it compare to Texas?
Yeah, we just did an economic impact study on mining across the U.S. And I can throw out a couple facts here for you. Texas has about $4 billion. In 2024, Texas Bitcoin miners spent about $4 billion on infrastructure for a combined gross product of about $1.6 billion. Paying their employees about $1 billion and created about 12,000 jobs in the state. That was in 2024. In the same time period in Georgia, you had about $800 million of infrastructure expenditure, $316 million of gross product GDP from mining activity in Georgia, and $196 million in payrolls, and then about 2,300 jobs. So I'd say, what is that, about a quarter, maybe a fifth. Georgia has about a fifth of the amount of Bitcoin mining in Texas or in Georgia than in Texas. Now, you'll see it over-indexed on some graphics because most of the mining in Georgia is public mining. It's like a lot of CleanSpark's data centers. So, and you know, I think CleanSpark uses Foundry. So if you look at like a Foundry pool, like distribution by state, they will way over index to Georgia and say like Georgia has like 30% of the US hash rate. But if you do like a pool analysis with multiple pools and you look at like actually the SEC data about where public miners have steel in the ground, and we were able to get a bunch of data from private miners too, because we kept it confidential. Economic impact study, we actually had the miners send it straight to the third party economic impact study firm, and the TBC never saw the data. We are just seeing the aggregated and anonymized data. So
do you think that's, is that something that other, blockchain councils are doing? I know there's many others. Are they doing the same studies, or do you provide the information to them, or how do you see that?
We'll provide it to them eventually. We haven't published it yet. We're still digesting it and creating like graphics and products, you know, visual products with the data. But I can tell you, we did it for 12 states. So we'll give it to those states. Washington State, Texas, Tennessee, South Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, New York, Nebraska, North Dakota, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Georgia. I think the state that we really missed out on that we should have done was Oklahoma. We were just basing it off of like where the public miners have the most hash rate, and there's not a lot of public mining in Oklahoma, but there's a ton of private mining. So we did do like a rest of the U.S. bucket so that we could get a total aggregate figure. So across the U.S. In 2024, Bitcoin miners spent about $10.5 billion in infrastructure spending and G&A spending. And then gross product of $4.1 billion, income for employees and for the employee numbers includes a multiplier effect, by the way. So it's not only just W-2, it's also 1099 and people whose jobs were created because of Bitcoin mining coming to an area. So about $2.5 billion in payroll and 31,000 jobs across the country. So you guys are getting that information early. It'll be public soon, but it'll be like a multi-page economic impact report.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us early. I do appreciate that. I do want to just take a second to thank our partners. Black Sheep Ammo, restock your ammo at blacksheepammo.com. Punch Plate, we need to stamp our seed phrase on metal plates. Don't leave it on paper. Go to punchplate.com. Get that taken care of ASAP. Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms and tactical training at paladintowertactics.com. And Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining. Go to solosatoshi.com. Use our code BTCVETS with an S. Get 5% off your order. Pay with Bitcoin, peer-to-peer. Additional 10% off. So potential for 15% off your order, solosatoshi.com. Bitcoin Alaska, July 5th and 6th in Juneau. Y'all, the tickets are going crazy for this event. You need to go get your tickets, get your lodging as well. This is a family-friendly conference. So bring your kids, bring your spouse, bring your in-laws. Make a trip out of it. I tell you this every weekday. Alaska is gorgeous. You are not going to want to leave once you get there this summer. So feel free to get a one-way ticket. It's in Juneau. Pre-conference activities take place on the 1st. We have a cruise scheduled. We have a fun run. We have kayaking. There is so much to do at this conference. This is not your traditional Bitcoin conference. Go to bitcoinalaska.org. Get that taken care of right away. So go ahead, Bob.
I was going to say, so Lee, maybe to bring it full circle again for people not expecting you to be an expert on all the other SBRs, but how do you see them comparing in other states? What other communications have you had with other blockchain councils? And maybe just talk about that for the audience.
Sure. Yeah, we've shared our bill with a couple of the other states. I won't say which ones just because maybe they want to keep that private. But I think there's a lot of great bills out there. And I don't know if Texas will be the first to pass. The earliest we could pass it and have it signed by a governor is like June, by Governor Abbott. So there's a pretty good chance that another state will beat us to the punch, but, they may not have as robust of a, it could be a small state or it could be a little bit less robust of a bill. We used to work with Satoshi Action Fund and Dennis. We've kind of stopped working with them. They've burned us a couple times. And so, we don't have as much communication with them. And I know they're probably running like 6 or 7 bills across other states. And then there's like different blockchain councils, like Andrew Birchwell is running the Ohio one. I know the guy up in New Hampshire is running that one. His name escapes me right now, but he's actually an elected official. He filed his own bill. There's kind of a combination. So you got 6 or 7 states that don't have blockchain councils that Satoshi Action is running those bills. And, I think those are fine bills. There's nothing wrong with those bills. And I think many of those bills might be the first ones to pass. They're a little bit different than the ones that Texas and Ohio and New Hampshire are running. I think who else is running a bill? Oklahoma, I think, is running their own bill. So, lots of good states out there trying to get it done. And, you know, there's people, there are also people like Nick Carter, who is a friend and I think is a very thoughtful person, is kind of negative about Bitcoin mining strategic reserves. And he and I, you know, had a little bit of banter about this, but, he's worried that it would undermine the dollar and like, why would the reserve currency issuer need to issue or like have a Bitcoin strategic reserve? Is that like admitting that the dollar is in fact flawed and weak? And could that hasten the dollar's decline as the world reserve currency? I just don't think that's the case because there are no better alternatives, right? I mean, Bitcoin will eventually be the better alternative, but that could take decades. There's no better fiat alternatives than the US dollar. So I don't think there's going to be a Bitcoin strategic reserves are going to be sizable enough to hasten the decline of the dollar. In fact, it could prolong the dollar, right? Because stable coins are going to prolong the dollar by being a forced buyer of US treasuries. And Bitcoin, if our strategic reserves are large enough, could actually increase investor confidence in treasuries and cause other central banks to hold more dollars. So I think in the long term, well, let me say it this way. In the short to medium term, a Bitcoin strategic reserve prolongs the dollar as the world reserve currency. I think in the long term, there's no doubt in my mind that the dollar will not be the world reserve currency in 50 years, just because that's just not, I don't ever tell that to elected officials because it scares them, but I don't think, you know, when you look at the history of fiat currencies and reserve currencies in particular, you just don't get as long of a run as we've had typically. I mean, you can, I think the pound in Great Britain and then the Dutch currency in like the 1600s maybe had like a century of world reserve currency status, but there is an end and we continue to spend like there's no tomorrow. I think, you know, Trump auditing all of these government agencies is a good thing, although he's undermining his own progress a little bit. Like yesterday on Air Force One, he said something like, there's some irregularities in T-bills and we might not have as much debt as we thought. Well, that is going to plummet demand, as you guys all know, for treasuries, right? If it's possible for the government to write off or to say, hey, there was irregularities and we don't need to pay these treasuries back, that's going to create a big problem for the bond market. And
Why did he say that? Give me your thoughts. I can't wrap my head around the reason for bringing that up. To me, it makes no sense.
I don't know. It's the same, you know, we obviously published a lot of concerns when the Trump meme coin came out. We're like, we love what Trump is doing for the American economy and what he's doing for the Bitcoin and digital asset industry, but this is wrong. This is not healthy. And so I'd say the same thing about the bond stuff. I think he probably has a short-term benefit of like maybe saying, well, maybe I can cancel out some of the debt if some of these treasury bills were issued with irregularities and we could put it in court. I don't know. He's probably got some very short-term win that he's going to achieve with saying that. But in my mind, it's the U.S. bond market is the most important bond market in the world. And so undermining that is undermining trust in that is a very dangerous game.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that. And yeah, I was just asking your opinion on that because I can't figure out the end game for that comment, just out of the blue.
Yeah, me neither.
So we're getting to the top of the hour, so I do want to start wrapping things up with you, Lee. Be respectful of your time. What advice can you give to others and who aren't fortunate enough to live here in Texas like us, if they want to increase their, you know, pro Bitcoin legislation getting passed? What advice do you have for them?
I guess what I would say is, you know, build a little bit of a grassroots movement and then go meet some legislators. And the Texas Blockchain Council was a paper dragon at first in that like legislators thought that we had more influence than we did like back in 2020. And so then they gave us more time and we were able to parlay that time into getting bills passed and achieving things that then grew our influence. So there was a flywheel effect But at first it was again, a bit of a paper dragon. So I'd just say become a paper dragon and then you eventually grow into an entity that has some influence in your state house, whatever state you're in. And from there you can create a little bit of a flywheel effect to actually get some stuff done.
Yeah, I think it helps that so many other states are starting to look at these things. And, you know, it seems like it's kind of all the buzz right now. Maybe that's because we live in an echo chamber, some of us. But it does seem like more and more states are continuing to add. I think there's maybe 12 or 13 and rumors of others. So seems like there would be maybe some legislators that would be interested in talking to people in other states if they wanted to provide resources.
Yeah, we're always happy to share best practices and share Word documents of drafts of bills and things that you could just change the name of the state type of deal.
What are your thoughts on the role of veterans and what they play with Bitcoin, the Bitcoin mission, and how can we get more veterans involved?
Yeah, I think, you know, especially veterans. So I don't claim to be a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan. I was never deployed there. So, you know, my hat is off to those of you on the call that were deployed. So I think those that served overseas have a special role to play in the conversation around national security and around spending the blood and treasure of the United States overseas for uncertain, like, goals. And I think Bitcoin really focuses people's attention when you don't have the money printer and you actually have hard assets. There is a real cost to conflict. And so I think communicating that and keeping the tip of the spear sharp for the U.S. military is certainly important. Just that's a deterrence mechanism, but also rarely using that spear is going to increase, you know, the flourishing of the U.S. economy and, you know, all Americans and the world as well. So I'd say veterans have a unique role in communicating that message to elected officials where those that haven't served don't have that opportunity.
Well, thank you for that. I got two rapid fire questions for you and then I'll go ahead and start wrapping up the show. If you had to orange pill one Texas politician, like turn him into a complete maxi, who's this going to be?
That's a great question. I'd say the comptroller right now. He's an elected, statewide elected official. He's a great guy. He was behind the Texas Bullion Depository. He and Chairman Capriglione and Senator Parker were the kind of the trio that brought the Texas Gold Depository to existence. If he became a maxi, then we would probably have $500 million in the Texas Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. You know, it would be substantial really fast.
There we go. All the Bitcoin veterans, go ahead and send them a letter and tell them about the boat analogy. That should turn them into a Bitcoin maxi. That's a little bit of an internal joke we have. And then last question I have for you, Lee. You're making chili. Are you putting beans in it or are you going to make a Frito pie?
I'll do both. I mean, I'm going to put beans in it and then I'm going to get chips and crush them up and put them inside the chili too.
No, you got to choose one or the other. It can't be both.
Okay. I'll probably do the beans.
I'm sad to hear you say that, Lee, as a Texan. Hey, but I do want to thank you so much for coming on here. I really did enjoy this conversation. This hour flew just right by. Where can I point everybody to help support you and what you've done with the Texas Blockchain Council?
I'd just say go to our website. The Texas Blockchain Council has a tab on there for the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve if you want to become like an ambassador. It's just texasblockchaincouncil.org/texas-strategic-bitcoin-reserve. Probably better to just go to the site and find that sublink in the heading because it's a long link. But anyways, that's where you can become an ambassador, figure out how to call your elected official. We'll give you, you know, a call sheet and email addresses and all that stuff.
Well, perfect. Well, thank you so much, Lee. It was an absolute pleasure, and we'll have to get you back on the space, hopefully in June when Abbott is signing this strategic Bitcoin reserve into law.
Maybe we could do a live spaces from the bill signing ceremony.
Let's do it. I'm going to pencil it in now so it's official. I really do like that, Lee. And again, thank you so much for coming on today.
Anytime. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you. So that's it, everybody. I do want to thank everyone who tuned in, everybody who retweeted the show, everybody who commented it in the comment section in the bottom right. It makes my job easier. It makes Bob's job easier. It's just more enjoyable. So we do this every Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Eastern time. We are the Bitcoin Veterans. You don't have to be a veteran to listen to us or to join. Go to bitcoinveterans.org, fill out that connect sheet, get in touch with us. We have tons of signal chats. We have every discussion possible on every topic. Don't sit on the sidelines. Get out there, reach out to us, and let's grow this community. And that's what this is all about, is how can we orange pill the world? How can we make a difference? It doesn't start on the national stage. It starts in your neighborhood. It starts with your neighbors. So it's very important that we start grassroots with this. First step on that is go ahead and reach out to us. So again, this is just an absolute fantastic show. It flew by. I can't believe it's already the top of the hour. Bob, do you have any comments that you'd like to say before we close it up?
No, I know Lee has already dropped, but yeah, I think it was a great, great discussion. Appreciate him for showing up. We have some other great guests this week, and yeah, look forward to doing it all again tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow will be a free-for-all. We don't have any guests lined up, but Wednesday we have John Dehaney, founder of My First Bitcoin. I'm positive I'm saying his name wrong, but I'm trying to say it like 100 different ways over the weekend, not to screw it up. but John, with founder of My First Bitcoin in El Salvador, joining us on the 12th, Wednesday. And then we have Pura Vida Bitcoin in Costa Rica joining us on Thursday, the 13th. So two good shows back to back. Really looking forward to this. Y'all aren't going to want to miss those, so make sure you set your reminders. We'll have links for those spaces in the on our X handle, and we'll go ahead and retweet them here in a bit. But that's it. That's all I have for you. Get out there and have a fantastic day. Thank you for listening. Just do not shitcoin. It's like trying to bail out a sinking boat with a sieve.